ladies and gentlemen.
My fellow citizens. 12, 11,
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You better leave here, sir. Come on.
And we will always have your back.
We have a liftoff.
Welcome to Life Lab Notes, where we review and compare our notes about life, what we have in common, what makes humans tick, and how we can keep from blowing up the lab. My father-in-law, Jerry Ward, wrote a memoir chronicling one of his careers. It has so many fascinating, thought-provoking details, told in his own no-big-deal style. Since it actually is a big deal, we decided to share some of it with you, in the hopes that you'll see yourself somewhere in this story. We present How to Fly a Jet and Other Life Lessons.
When I entered DePauw University in the late summer of 1952, the Korean War, it was not a police action, as Truman called it, was still raging.
Those are the words of Jerry Ward, read by his son, Phil Ward.
I joined the Air Force ROTC unit at DePauw, which meant that upon graduation, I would be commissioned a second lieutenant and would soon receive my orders to report for active duty.
Now, right away, we're going to seem to break from our main story, but this is a story about dreams and leaving your comfort zone to chase after them.
In the fall of 53, I espied a comely lass in my biology class. With a bit of effort, I found that her name was Gail Loomis from Kansas City. She was a freshman and a Delta Gamma. A couple weeks later, my folks were visiting for Parents Weekend. While walking back from the football game, I noticed Gail ahead of us, pointed her out to my folks, and said I was thinking of asking her for a date. My dad said,
"You better get on it, or it might be too late."
That's the voice of Jerry Ward, who was lovingly tricked into quoting his dad's excellent advice.
So I screwed up my courage, asked her for a date. To my relief, she said yes. More dates followed, and soon we were an item. In the spring of 54, we were pinned, and in December of 55, we were engaged. Gail's folks agreed to bring her to my training base in late June after she graduated, and we would be married in the base chapel.
While waiting for his orders, Jerry had one more summer to work in one of the two Del Monte canning plants in his hometown of Rochelle, Illinois, something he had done every summer through high school and college. Summer stretched into fall, the canning season ended, and still no orders. Jerry began working for the Rochelle Gas Company to make a little more money and driving to DePauw nearly every weekend to be with Gail at school.
One day, Dad's Argosy magazine arrived. Pictured on the front was the Air Force's newest and hottest fighter, the sleek-looking F-104 Starfighter. The article was titled, "Missile with a Man in It." The little fighter was capable of Mach 2, twice the speed of sound, in level flight. As I devoured the article, I thought to myself, wouldn't it be something to fly this plane? Finally, my orders arrived. I was to report to Lackland Air Force Base for officers' pre-flight training between December 5th and 7th. It was a strange and somewhat lonely feeling driving away from my home of 22 years, striking out on my own. I drove to Texas by way of DePauw, where Gail and I bid a tearful farewell, knowing we would not see each other again for over 6 months. I drove through the gates at Lackland Air Force Base the afternoon of December 7th, 1956, my 22nd birthday. I was now an active duty member of the United States Air Force.
This meant paperwork. Lots of it. Along with intensive physical exams, purchasing uniforms, and being indoctrinated to Air Force life.
The first week in January, our training base assignments came through. The first phase of becoming a pilot was called primary flight training. At that time, the Air Force farmed out this phase to civilian flying schools located in several smaller communities around the country. I was assigned to Bainbridge Air Base in Bainbridge, Georgia, a small town in the southwest corner of the state, about 30 miles northwest of Tallahassee. I arrived there the second week of January. I filled out the requisite forms at HQ, received verbal and written instructions, and was assigned my quarters. I was now a member of Primary Flight Training Class 58H, a number no pilot forgets. reporting to the flight line for my first day of training, I was introduced, along with four other students, to Mr. Patterson, our instructor. Pat was a World War II vet, as were most of the instructors, had flown B-17s in Europe, and was one of the nicest men you'd ever meet. He introduced all of us to our first trainer, the T-34.
This was a small, single-engine, propeller-driven, fully acrobatic plane, the Air Force's initial primary flight trainer at contract pilot training air bases across the southern United States.
We were to receive 50 hours in the T-34. This consisted largely of the basics of flying, acrobatics, communications, emergency procedures, and familiarization with the area. One of the first orders of business was the blindfold cockpit check. We learned where every switch, handle, lever, and circuit breaker was, and then had to touch them all and identify them while blindfolded. This was standard procedure with every plane I flew. Pat showed us the walk-around visual inspection of the plane. I settled into the front cockpit while Pat took the rear seat. As I strapped myself in, Pat gave me one of the best pieces of advice I would receive. He said to remember that I wasn't strapping myself to the plane. I was strapping the plane to me. I was the boss.
Jerry trained in the piston engine T-34 and T-28 propeller planes. Flying and aerobatic skills, cross-country navigation, omnidirectional radio codes, instrument flying.
We would fly by reference to our instruments only. This was to prepare us to cope with difficult weather conditions if and when they should occur. The instructor was in front and the student in back. By pulling forward a curtain called the hood, the student covered the canopy inside and could not see outside except for an occasional sneak peek at the front edge of the hood. Our instrument training started with the instrument takeoff. The instructor would line up the plane with the center of the runway, and the student would close the hood, usually followed by a deep breath and a Hail Mary or two. The instructor would shake the control stick and say, "You have the plane." The student would shake the stick and reply, "I have it." This procedure was standard when pilots transferred control between them. We were told accidents had occurred because each pilot thought the other was flying the plane. Lined up with the runway, I would advance the throttle and keep my directional needle centered through use of the rudder pedals. At takeoff speed, I would pull the stick back, lift off, raise the gear, and climb away from the runway at the proper speed and, by cross-checking my instruments, maintain control. It kept one very busy, but it became somewhat easier with practice. One thought that never completely leaves a pilot's mind is that of a mid-air collision. At a training base with so many planes in the air, it is especially important to keep your head on a swivel. One day, I was blithely tooling along at altitude on instruments when the stick was slapped violently from my hand. Yelling, "I have it," the instructor threw the plane into a violent maneuver. I was wondering what the hell just happened when he righted the plane and told me to come out from under the hood. In a calm voice, he told me that we had been belly to belly with another plane for a few moments. My closest call. I never saw it happen.
The next plane Jerry flew was the T-33. Despite it being one number behind the T-34, it was actually much more advanced, being
the trainer version of the F-80 Shooting Star, the Air Force's first operational jet fighter.
And Jerry's first jet engine experience.
As we students gathered around the straight-winged T-33, we were duly impressed by its size and presence before us. The lieutenant was imparting a book's worth of information as we circled the plane. In turn, we climbed the ladder to peek into the cockpit. Holy smoke! This wasn't our T-28 cockpit looking back at us. We were stunned by the complexity in the switches, gauges, circuit breakers, and handles in abundance. Comparatively, the T-28 was a toy.
The blind cockpit tests were getting more complicated. In the T-33, they were to receive 100 hours of formation flying, weather flying, navigation, and getting used to working with and against gravity.
Prior to my first flight, I received the flight manual for the plane, a couple of flight suits and boots, and my G-suit. The G-suit was a pair of leggings with a very wide band around the stomach, all of which zipped on. In the leggings and across the stomach were inflatable bladders within the suit, and a hose came out at the waist. When seated, the hose was plugged into a receptacle in the cockpit. When more than a couple of G's were pulled, air would come through the hose and fill the bladders, which would press against the legs and stomach, helping to keep the blood flowing to the extremities. The more G's pulled, the more air filled the bladders and pressed on you. We were also taught to tighten our stomachs as much as possible. We experienced this in the air so as to be aware of when we were close to passing out from lack of blood to the brain. The G-suit and gritting the stomach helped a lot, but if you pulled enough G's, about six or more, and didn't release stick pressure,